Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. On this weekend show, we're going to be taking more of a big picture look at the economy, the U.S. economy, as well as what's going on around the world, central bank policies, how they're influencing some of the recent data and even future data that we're going to be seeing, and then diving into the markets, including commodities, with two of our favorite more generalist commentators that focus on economic data as well as drive down into the markets. You're going to hear from Jesse Felder as well as Peter Bukvar sharing their insights. I'm sure a lot of similarities and I'm sure also some differences too. So I hope you all enjoy this weekend show, and please keep in touch with us and visit our website and subscribe to our podcast. Just search the KE Report in your podcast player so that you get updates on all our daily editorials and company updates we record from throughout the week. Let's get into this weekend show with Jesse Felder, founder and editor of the Felder Report. Now, Jesse, we took the summer off from chatting, and I'm happy to have you back on to get more of an update, starting with a recent article that you sent out to subscribers, the title simply saying, "What if interest rates are both too low and too high?" This brings up a lot of questions about Fed policy, global central bank policy. Now, when we are in this world where we're seeing some gradual cuts from a lot of central banks, that will tie into, again, what the economy is doing and economic data. So, Jesse, break down that article, what you're pointing out with interest rates potentially being both too low and too high.
Well, I have to give full credit to Bernard Connolly, whose new book I read recently, You Always Hurt the One You Love. And the subtitle of the book is Central Banks and the Murder of Capitalism. It's just it's a long, dense read, but it's very interesting. And he makes the point that the way, you know, this activist monetary policy that we've seen for the last several decades, you know, very aggressive discretionary monetary policy, has created a situation where you get these huge pull forwards of demand, and then they leave a vacuum in their wake. And it really kind of screws up the normal capital cycle, the normal economic cycle, and creates these situations where, you know, the Fed is in a very difficult position. And they've increasingly done this through the cycle to kind of get things so, you know, off kilter that it's very difficult to analyze the economy and kind of understand where we're at. And so really the point is that interest rates are possibly too high. And this is kind of where, you know, the argument I was making in the piece this week is that interest rates are essentially too high to allow for a soft landing in the economy. And they're too low to really bring inflation back down to the Fed's target in a sustainable way. And so when you have markets that have now completely priced in a soft landing, and I thought it was very notable this to see today, the New York Times publish a piece about how there's a renewed sense of optimism across Wall Street, as, you know, the consensus has been that the Fed has achieved a soft landing. You know, when you see that in the mainstream media, it's a lot of times an important sentiment signal. And in that respect, I think there's probably a good possibility that inflation will not come back down to target, you know, that in the short run, it could stay around this current level, but it's likely to head back up to the 3-4% range in a more sustainable way. At the same time, there are signs the economy is slowing significantly and that a soft landing in the economy just may not be possible with the trajectory of the labor market and these types of things. So we might actually get a more stagflationary outcome of persistently elevated inflation and, you know, recessionary type economy.
Well, Jesse, just to that point, let's weave in inflation and interest rates into a discussion about where inflation actually is, because there's a lot of people that if you were using older metrics, the 1980s or 1990s metrics, inflation is still quite a bit higher than it's being reported right now, the way they calculate CPI and the core and the super core. And if you look at where GDP is estimated, you know, some would argue that we're actually still in negative real rates, even though the market is saying when they're looking at the TIPS market that we're in positive real rates. So how do you, I guess, balance those out where everyday citizens inflation rates are, if you go look at food prices or look at fast food prices or look at, you know, what's happening in retail versus what you're seeing on the CPI versus the growth we're seeing. Are we in a negative real rate environment, or are we actually in the positive real rate as it's being reported in the TIPS market?
I think the point I would just make, and this kind of comes back to something Stan Druckenmiller was talking about last week at the Grants conference, is that you have unemployment's very low, the gold price at record highs, stock prices at record highs, corporate spreads at essentially all-time lows. It's very difficult to make the case that monetary policy is significantly restrictive today, which is, you know, as the Fed wants us to believe, that, you know, a 5% foreign change policy rate is above the neutral rate and significantly restrictive. There aren't really any signs in the markets that, that policy rate is restrictive. So, but I would just point out, when, you know, you're thinking about inflation, you know, the biggest, you know, one of the biggest issues that I have is you look at something like health insurance, right? And according to CPI, health insurance is down 10% or something along those lines over the last couple of years. But then you actually look at health insurance rates, and not only are rates up double digits over the last couple of years, deductibles have also gone up. So if you were to adjust those hedonically, to use a word that the economists like to use, they would be going up even faster than the double digits when you factor in rising deductibles and rising copays and these kinds of things too. So, you know, I think it is it's a fair argument to be made that CPI doesn't necessarily reflect the reality of inflation. I think, you know, there are measures that do, that come closer. So you look at, you mentioned super core inflation, you know, core services less housing, is still, I think, you know, 4% plus year over year. And you look at median CPI, essentially what's the middle number? And it's at 3% and change, which means more than half of all the components within CPI are running at above 3% year over year. So, you know, there's a lot of celebration that the Fed has tamed inflation, brought it back down to target. But even if you look beneath the headline measures of inflation, the measures of, you know, the Atlanta Fed sticky price CPI and all of these types of things that kind of measure the persistence, inflation persistence, suggest they're not even close to bringing inflation back to target yet. So I think on the inflation side of things, it's very difficult to make the case that, yeah, mission accomplished, inflation is back down to the 2% in a sustainable way.
So, Jesse, you made the comment that you think inflation could go back up to the 3-4% region. Look, a lot of things impact inflation, money printing, supply chain disruptions, wages, commodities, China issues. A lot of them tie into each other, and a lot of them have their own little drivers. What do you think are the key drivers moving forward that will move inflation, at least as it's reported, up to that 3-4%?
I think the biggest problem for inflation right now is the fact that these other measures that I suggested, core services inflation, essentially, you know, tracks wages in the services economy, are still 4% plus, and that's not coming down. We're actually not even seeing housing inflation kind of come down in the way that most economists and the Fed anticipated. And so that's proving to be stickier than anybody kind of thought it would be. What has driven disinflation over the past, you know, year or two is goods inflation. We've seen goods prices essentially collapse and turn negative. And that has been a very strong deflationary force within the overall CPI. What we saw this last month is that goods inflation or deflation has bottomed out and is starting to reverse higher. And so all of the disinflationary impact that has created is essentially going away. And if that's the case, while services inflation remains sticky, then you're going to see headline measures start to trend back up closer to where services is. So, you know, right now we're 2 and change or something on, you know, headline. We're probably headed back up to 3 and change if goods prices are starting to turn back up again and services is going to remain sticky, which it looks like that is. And so, you know, you just look at the cost of shipping, the cost of, you know, commodities prices and things have kind of bottomed and turned higher recently as part of China stimulus and these types of things. And so there's a lot of things that point to that, you know, renewed inflation in goods. And I think that would be the main driver over the next several months.
Well, Jesse, you had brought up rates being too high and too low for different factors. But when you look at the yield curve, it's finally uninverted. After 2 years of being inverted, it's finally steepened on the long end of the curve. So we finally have the 10 above the 2 and the 30 above the 10. So when you look at that, does that give you any pause that often in history, when the yield curve finally uninverts, that's the moment where the contraction in the economy shows up? Is that a concern? And do you think that these rates have been trying to do the Fed's work for them ahead of these rate cuts?
Yeah, I think, you know, that typically is the recession signal when you get the uninversion of the yield curve. And we had a not so good jobs report for August. And then the September report came in and everybody thought, oh, my gosh, 250,000 jobs. You know, this is amazing. So maybe the economy is a lot better than expected. But there were a lot of problems with that jobs number. I mean, the seasonality factor was the biggest we've ever seen in history. You know, and that accounted for potentially 100,000 of the 250,000 jobs created. And so there's, you know, and full-time employment continues to decline, underemployment still really weak. And that's even before you factor in, you know, the revisions to which are inevitably going to come due to things like the birth death model. So, you know, it's amazing how much people focus on, you know, these job reports. The labor market is, you know, classically a lagging economic signal. And so many of these leading economic signals, like the yield curve and like these types of things, point to significant weakness in the labor market. I would just make one point about the bond market, which is that before this backup in yields, you know, the term premium was very, very low on longer term bonds. Essentially, you're getting paid, you know, very, very little for taking long term interest rate risk at a time when the government is, you know, running massive deficits. And this is one of the reasons, I believe, why two of the greatest investors that I've seen during my career, Warren Buffett and Stan Druckenmiller, are essentially short long bonds at this point in the cycle for the first time in their careers. I mean, Stan Druckenmiller has said he made the vast majority of his profits betting on central bank mistakes, essentially buying bonds in a massively levered way when the economy was slowing down and headed for recession. That he's short bonds today instead of long bonds, you know, says a lot. And Buffett, by the same token, I remember in the very late 90s, the last time he was building up such a massive cash position in Berkshire, not quite as big as he has built up today in terms of the overall percentage of the portfolio. But back then he was, you know, buying zero coupon bonds, essentially betting on falling interest rates. Today, there's no zero coupons in the portfolio. There's no bonds of any duration. He's now the single largest owner of Treasury bills. And so that points suggests to me that both Buffett and Druckenmiller are worried about the potential for a real backup in rates, you know, much more significant than what we've seen over the last couple weeks. And so, you know, I think that's another interesting dynamic going on in the markets that not enough people are paid attention to.
So, Jesse, now that we do have the Fed with one rate cut, Canada, I think, has had three rate cuts. Other central banks have also been cutting rates outside of what the market is predicting, because that market swings so much. What do lower rates do for the economy, for the markets? Are they good? Are they bad? Is everybody on the wrong side of thinking that rate cuts are going to be good across the board?
Well, you know, rate cuts take, just like the rate hikes, right? They take a long time to work through the economy. And that's probably what the Fed is thinking right now, is that if the economy is slowing, they don't want to be behind the curve, you know, because it takes a year or two for those falling interest rates to kind of work their magic on the economy. They need to really try and get ahead of the curve. And so if you look at like the Beige Book and things that show real significant weakness in the labor market, that's what the Fed is responding to, is saying, hey, look, if the, you know, typically what happens when the labor market weakens, it doesn't just weaken and then plateau, it accelerates in that direction. And you get, as you know, Bill Dudley put it, kind of a self-reinforcing dynamic where people are afraid of losing their jobs. They spend less. Those companies make less in profit. They need to cut jobs, which makes people worry about their jobs more, and vice versa. All right, so on and so forth. So I think that, you know, that's kind of where we're at. The Fed wants to, you know, get ahead of that dynamic, and they certainly are now more worried about that side of the mandate than they are on the inflation side of the mandate. Now, that sends a very clear message to investors that if the Fed's going to make a mistake, they're going to make a mistake on the inflation side. They'd rather support and make the mistake of being too supportive of the labor market and allow inflation to pick back up again than they would, you know, be more Paul Volcker-ish and say, hey, we're going to make sure inflation doesn't come back, even if it costs us a very difficult recession. That, you know, this is the anti, you know, Volcker monetary policy regime, where they're not willing at all to do that. Of course, behind that, the unspoken motivation is not just the, you know, labor side of the mandate, but it's also the fact that interest expense for the government is off the chart and it's becoming a problem. So the Fed needs to lower interest rates, not just for the labor market, but also to try and reduce the interest rate burden on the federal government. So I think that's, you know, the main takeaway investors should have is that the Fed is determined to miss on the inflation side.
Well, Jesse, let's dive into the general markets a little bit more and merge some of this macro data with it, because when you look at it, the markets themselves have had a fantastic year. Some of that lines up with the last year of a presidential cycle before the changeover in administration, but it's also just been a year of expecting this loosening policy from the central banks to juice the markets, which it has. The markets have been hitting all-time highs, the S&P, the NASDAQ, and it's not just the mega cap tech stocks now. It has broadened out in breadth into some other sectors like the value sector, the healthcare, the financials, REITs, and we've even seen some of the small caps get a bid. Where are we at in this cycle? Are we at the end of a cycle here? Are we in a new bull market cycle? Are we at risk of a market correction? Where do you think we are relative to the U.S. equity markets?
Well, if there's one indicator, macro indicator, that I could have and get rid of all the rest, if I could only have one, it would be the aggregate activity of insiders in their own shares. So what are the leaders of corporate America doing with their own money in the stock market? And that right now, in aggregate, insiders are more bearish than they've ever been in at least a decade. The total 12-month sell-to-buy ratio has only been this high in November, you know, as it is today, in November of 2021. That was a very clear message about, you know, where the market and earnings were headed over the next 12 to 24 months. And we saw a painful bear market in 2022, right in the wake of that activity. But I would just point out, too, that the actual insight, it's not just selling that's driving this. And we've seen, you know, like literally last quarter was the most selling by semiconductor insiders in history. Right. And so semiconductors have been one of these momentum trades driving the market higher, led by NVIDIA. We've never seen so much insider selling as we did last quarter in that sector. But it's really lack of buying that is really, I think, the biggest problem right now, or the clearest message from insiders. 12-month insider buying fell to a level we haven't seen since 2012. And so for insiders to be buying less stock than they have in over a decade is a very clear message that they see no reason to take risk in the equity market right now, that valuations aren't compelling. And, you know, when you take that total buying and compare it to market cap, it's literally the least amount of insider buying we've ever seen in the history of the data that I've looked at. And so that's a very clear message from the leaders of corporate America that they do not think that the economy and earnings and stock prices are going to meet expectations over the next 1 to 2 years.
Man, it has just been a crazy run for these markets. The S&P, I think, is up 10 out of the last 11 months. And, well, it's done pretty well this month, too. This year, the S&P is up 20%. Last year, it was up 25%. Jesse, what's driven this move then? Is it all just everyone accepting rate cuts? Is it the whole no other options for investors, even though they can get some returns in money market funds, but those are drastically lagging? Why have these markets been so strong?
Well, I think it's animal spirits. I think that's the only thing you can really attribute it to, because there are alternatives. As John Authors pointed out yesterday in his piece for Bloomberg, the 10-year treasury yield is now above the earnings yield of the S&P 500 for the first time in 22 years. So first time in 22 years, bonds now offer a greater yield than stocks in terms of earnings yield. I don't think that's a wonderful way to compare, you know, the two asset classes. But you still get 5% on T-bills today, or close to it. So there are alternatives out there. I think it's just that investors are so enamored of the stock market that they continue to pour money into passive vehicles, right? We've seen this year, I think we've already broken records for money going into the big Vanguard and BlackRock total market S&P 500 index funds. A lot of that is just, you know, 401k kind of stuff, automatic, you know, with withdrawals from paychecks that just go straight into the market. But also you look at the allocation, you know, that households, investors have put in the equity market. It's just the highest, you know, that it's ever been. It's essentially matched with March of 2000, first quarter of 2000, where 48% of household assets are allocated to the stock market. It's never been higher than that. And so, you know, you have that dynamic, the passive dynamic. And then I think there's a third dynamic too, which is just, you know, a purely speculative element. We've seen so much money go into zero day to expiry call options, into longer term call options for things like Nvidia. I mean, Nvidia dominates the options market every day. There's just tons of money, you know, being people buying calls. And for a while it was Tesla. And, you know, sometimes it's Apple, and it just rotates among those magnificent seven companies, whichever one's hot, you know, there's just, you know, like moths to a flame and people going into the options markets. And then there's leveraged ETFs, right? People point out and say, well, margin debt isn't that high. Well, why would you take on margin debt when interest rates are the highest in 20 years? Makes no sense. But a leveraged ETF, right? I don't have to pay interest. I can buy, you know, and literally a 2x or 3x NVIDIA ETF, and I don't have to take on any margin debt. They have that for, you know, QQQ levered to the upside. The assets in leveraged ETFs are also at record highs. I mean, tens of billions of dollars poured into these leveraged vehicles. So I think that is really kind of what explains it. And it's driven by this soft landing narrative that the Fed has pulled off a soft landing. So, you know, it's very much like the Dick Fold Lehman quote, you know, while the music's still playing, we're going to keep dancing. And that's what investors are doing, is they're continuing to speculate as long as the market can levitate. And I think we're very closely nearing that time where it's not going to be able to levitate much longer.
Yeah, Jesse, they are definitely back with the speculative fervor. And like you're saying, the options market indicate that, but also the use of those 2x, 3x ETFs to get that extra leverage. But when you look at that, it's a weird backdrop to see gold, which is usually considered a safe haven or defensive element, doing so well in tandem with recently a rising dollar, but also with the markets doing so well. What do you make of the strength of gold in an environment where people are so happy to speculate?
Well, it's interesting to me. I mean, it's been amazing to me to see, you know, S&P 500 up 20% this year, gold up 30% this year. And, you know, the former garners all kinds of interest and headlines, and the interest in gold is totally just not there. There, you know, you look at the number of, it's one thing I track in Bloomberg, is the number of articles that mention gold, and we're, you know, it's still, you know, on the floor. There, you look at the assets and ETFs, and there's just no interest. But there are obviously, you know, drivers taking the price to highs at central banks around the world. And there's something that these central banks around the world clearly realize that Western investors have not figured out yet. And that's, you know, it's not so much gold rising as currencies declining in value versus, you know, stable type of asset like the gold price. And I think that really is the best way to characterize it is, you know, we were just talking about inflation, right? The purchasing power of the dollar has declined dramatically over the last few years. That's now just beginning to be reflected in the gold price. And so, you know, there's a lot of central banks around the world that say, hey, look, we don't want to be so heavily allocated, dependent upon dollars, you know, for national security reasons, but also for the reason that it looks like, I mean, and this is very much related to what I mentioned earlier about the bond market with Buffett and Druckenmiller not wanting to own long-term treasuries, is that we're very clearly headed for some type of a fiscal, I don't want to use too strong of a term, but some type of a fiscal problem where potentially, you know, if we were to go into recession and see revenues, I'm talking tax revenues, decline as they normally do in recession and blow out the deficit even further than it is, you could really see some problems in the bond market, because that would mean supply has to, you know, increase dramatically at a time when there really isn't enough potential demand in the bond market to kind of soak it all up. So I think there are a lot of reasons out there, but mainly it's that the you know, fiscal profligacy is accelerating right now. You look at both of the presidential candidates and they're both trying to outdo each other in terms of that profligacy. So, you know, it's not an encouraging message for bondholders. And so I think that's what is really driving the gold price. I think as that narrative becomes a little bit more well understood by Western investors, we're going to finally see that money start coming back into gold ETFs and things in a big way.
So, Jesse, yes, gold has done very well. We've even started to see some significant inflows into the gold ETFs. Silver has started to do well, too, and the gold stocks have done decently, but they're arguably not outperforming the way that investors would like to see when you see the rest of the market doing so well as well. So what's it going to take for silver to get back up potentially to those all-time highs and for gold stocks to really start outperforming?
Well, I think silver is pretty darn cheap relative to the gold price. I think we're at that point. In the short run, I think, you know, we have some potential for more just kind of seasonal weakness here in the precious metals over the next, you know, month or maybe two. You know, I say that from a seasonal perspective, but also from, you know, where we are in the monetary cycle. You know, if you look back at the last cycle, we're kind of in that stage where Jay Powell pivoted in late 18, early 19, and then it wasn't until kind of late 19 that we had the repo fiasco. And that really kicked, you know, gold into a higher gear. I think we're kind of waiting. We're in that in-between period where, yes, the central bank has pivoted, but we might need to wait for something to break in the financial plumbing before you really get that next strong leg higher in precious metals. I think it's probably coming. I don't know where it's going to come from, but it seems to, you know, rise up in every cycle, every monetary cycle. We see this. And so I think we're headed for that time. So in the very short run, we could get some more consolidation in the precious metals, but we're headed for a time where I do think the Fed is going to have to respond to some type of, you know, plumbing or something going wrong in the financial markets. And that will be the trigger for the next leg higher in the markets, along with probably, you know, more interest rate cuts. At that time, that's when you're going to see, I think, silver and the miners lead to the upside, because that's when you're going to get those Western investors saying, hey, look, this is the time to get involved. And they're going to be the ones who really drive that push. And typically that, you know, you see that not just go into the gold price, but it goes into those higher beta things like silver and the miners.
Well, Jesse, I know you also follow the energy sector pretty closely, and it's a big component of inflation. It's a big component of what kind of discretionary income consumers have. It affects the business and the freight and, you know, all parts of the society. What is your outlook on oil and nat gas and the energy stocks? Because they're always on a wild roller coaster ride, but there's a lot of people on both camps, the bull and the bear camp. How are you looking at the energy space?
Well, for the past, I don't know, 6 months or so, I've been saying that, you know, the two most hated asset classes on the planet, number one and number two, were Chinese equities and energy stocks. And obviously, Chinese equities aren't that hated anymore. They had a huge pop recently. They're giving some of that back lately. But I think that leaves now the energy sector, the energy space, as the most hated asset class on the planet. And I think that's not necessarily deserved. You know, I mentioned Buffett earlier. The only thing, you know, he's been selling Apple significantly. He's been selling down his Bank of America stake. As I said, he's avoiding long-term treasury bonds. But what has he been buying? He's been buying Occidental Petroleum. It's really the only significant purchases that he's been making over the past year or two. But you also look at like Carlos Slim doing the same thing. PBF Energy, a big refiner. Mexican billionaire who's been buying literally almost in the market every day, buying some energy stocks. Another one that I've been looking at, Jerry Jones owns about 70% of the Comstock Energy outstanding shares. He just made some recent big purchases in Comstock. And then the founder of, you know, Fortress Capital, big private equity firm, has been buying New Fortress Energy. So it's literally the only insider buying of note that I see is in the energy space. And, you know, energy stocks today, as my friend Callum Thomas pointed out, are essentially as cheap as they've ever been relative to the broad market. I think they're a very interesting contrarian play. They're a value play. And what's, I think, most interesting about them in terms of a timing perspective is that the oil price typically bottoms, right? Just like the yield curve inverts or uninverts right at the start of recession, the oil price bottoms right at the start of recession and begins to anticipate fiscal stimulus. And so oil price starts going up. You know, there's potentially, we've seen both of those things happen at the same time. Oil prices bottom and the yield curve uninvert at the same time. That could have been the signal that recession has started. If so, we'll start hearing more about potential stimulus to support not just rate cuts, but maybe potentially on the fiscal side as well to try and address a recessionary economy. If that's the case, I mean, we're already seeing it massively in China, and that will continue. And that's part of one of the reasons why oil price, you know, has done what it's done. If China continues and we see the U.S., you know, the rest of the world kind of come around to that stimulative view, we're going to see oil prices bottom and trend significantly higher over the next few years.
So what about some of these other energy sources then? Some of the greener energy sources like wind, solar, and even mixing in nuclear. Man, we've heard a lot more news in the uranium and nuclear sector. So where do you stand on some of these other cleaner energy sources?
We've seen tons of them, you know, built out recently. And I think it's difficult to make money on them. I think because as my friends at Gehring and Rosenzweig have pointed out, we've never seen an energy transition that moves to a less efficient form of energy, which is what all of these things are. They're intermittent, they're not consistent, and they don't produce a return on investment anywhere near what fossil fuels or nuclear produces. And so, you know, there are obviously environmental reasons and climate change reasons to make these investments, but as from an investor's standpoint, I don't think they make a great deal of sense. I think in the very short run, I'm very intrigued by natural gas. I think it's been really cheap, just like silver's cheap relative to gold. Natural gas is cheap relative to the oil price. And there's a huge opportunity. I mean, this is one of the stocks I mentioned, New Fortress Energy, is getting involved in shipping liquid natural gas overseas. You know, they can buy it for $2 here, sell it in Europe for $12, make a $7 spread. In the very short run, I think natural gas is a very interesting transitional fuel where we can bring on natural gas power plants much, much more quickly than we can bring on nuclear or anything else. Actually, New Fortress has a model that they built out in Puerto Rico as an emergency system where they can bring a new natural gas plant online in 120 days, which is a lot faster than, you know, 3 to 5 years than, you know, is in the case for most power generation. And so I think natural gas is very interesting right now.
Well, Jesse, just as we look at the rest of the commodities complex, a lot of it is in the eye of China and the Chinese economy because they're such a huge manufacturing hub. They're such a huge engine of growth. They're such a huge engine of using all things commodities. When you look at things like copper or other base metals, what do you think the lay of the land is in relation to if we're going to have that hard or soft landing?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, we're definitely headed, I personally think we're headed for a hard landing, and we're probably already there. You know, to me, that New York Times article today that essentially celebrated the arrival of the soft landing, and I've seen a few of them over the last couple of weeks, are that, you know, the almost the exact same kind of magazine cover indicator that we saw, you know, from Bloomberg in 2019, the death of inflation and these types of things. As soon as people, you know, kind of celebrate something, it's usually a sign that, you know, that they're dead wrong. And, you know, I don't wish for a hard landing in the economy, but I think that it's an inevitable outcome from the mistakes the Fed made during COVID, massively overstimulating, creating a huge inflation problem, being very late behind the curve to deal with it, and then having to do, you know, a rapid 180 in terms of monetary policy. To me, all of the signs already suggest that, you know, there's a good chance we're already in recession. And if not, it's likely going to be here very soon. Now, from a commodity standpoint, as I said, you know, China has already been in recession for a long time. They're already in stimulation mode, and they're the biggest consumers of commodities. So from a commodity standpoint, I think it's very bullish that China is already trying to, you know, stimulate their economy, and that should be bullish for commodities. And as I said, too, typically what you see in the oil price and the commodities markets generally are the oil price, is that it bottoms right at the start of a recession. And so I think, you know, this bottom that we've seen in oil prices over the last month or two could be that signal that recession has begun and oil prices is in the process of bottoming in reaction to the shift, the global shift in monetary and fiscal policy that is already underway globally.
All right, Jesse, we'll wrap it up here, but we're going to be following up with you in the upcoming months and into next year to see how this more or less recession call plays out, what the economy does, and where the markets go from here. I hope everybody enjoyed this conversation with Jesse Felder. Everyone, stick around. We are going to be right back, continuing our discussion on where the economy lies and where the market lies. Jesse, thank you for your time.
Thanks, guys. Always great to talk with you.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.